And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. And Bruce, we are going to be joined by a special guest later, a guy we covered back in his Florida State days. And
even before that, you go back
a long, long ways with Myron Roll. So he has a book out. We want to talk to him about that. But first, we want to get to some things happening in college football. Pretty significant news coming related to college football. But first, we have a cool series on The Athletic this week, revisiting this most recent coaching carousel, going behind the scenes of some of the more significant hires. I had one on the Lincoln Riley USC hire that I wrote with Antonio Morales. And you have one that went up Wednesday morning on the Miami Mario Cristobal hire with our Miami writer, Manny Navarro. You guys can read that on The Athletic. Go to theathletic.com/theaudible for a special deal. But tell us a little bit what you may have learned in your reporting for this that you didn't previously know about how that all went down.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting for a lot of people to look at and say, okay, yeah, the U is back. We've heard that before. We hear that all the time. But what we really got into is why things are so different. What's really different? The financial commitment. It's not just that. It's really, I think, the emphasis more than anything that they have put on. As Mario Cristobal told me this week himself, he was like, look, the powers that be in Miami kind of knew, like, I was at a place that had great resources, that my family loved it there. And we weren't going to talk to anybody until after the season. That couldn't happen. But they knew if they were going to approach me, then they better show that they were serious about winning national titles. And, you know, now 6 months later, as you know, we've done this, Manny and I did this story, everything that they had said would be lined up, not only has been lined up, it's probably even been even more emphatic than he'd even hoped, right down to the staff that he was able to put together. And so in the story, we were able to really give a TikTok on what was happening behind the scenes. It's really an inside story, not just that, but also how Cristobal ended up hiring this staff with a bunch of home run hires, where, you know, a lot of times Miami had not been able to afford some guys that, you know, they may have targeted. I mean, you go back to when Randy Shannon was the head coach, I think he landed on his Patrick Nix was like literally his 10th choice to be the offensive coordinator. So I think it'll give people a real picture of what is going on at Miami right now and why.
It really is dramatic. I mean, I just feel like for so long, the storyline around Miami athletics was they don't have money. They don't have a chance to get a coach of that caliber or that profile. I remember it was very odd, you know, without knowing what we know now, that couple week period where it seemed like Manny Diaz is going to get fired, or maybe he's going to stay if they don't get Chris, you know, and yeah, that really turned out to be the strategy. So now that it's happened, you know, and I think this ties in obviously with the John Ruiz and his, you know, very public throwing money around toward Miami athletics. It's like, it's a completely different climate there. So we will see how successful he may be.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's as he said himself, I was at a place with great resources, great facilities, and we loved it there. But this is, you know, this is home. And I think, you know, there's a part of the story where he says to me, you know, is like, it was probably almost 25 years ago. He's breaking into coaching. And Butch Davis, you know, was like, you really sure you want to be a coach? And goes through all the things that end up, you know, happening or that you miss out on in life if you're a football coach. And he just says back to him, I want to be in your seat. And now, whatever it is, you know, 23 years later, that's where he is. And so I think people will get it. Like, this story, I think Miami fans will like, but I think it's also, you know, a lot of college football fans, it'll probably open some eyes, because for so long, so many people have thought, you know, this is, you know, what's up with this place. And now I think you have if you read the story, you'll have a real feel for it. Let me ask you a question. So as you mentioned on this series, you and our USC beat writer, Antonio Morales, did a story on when Lincoln Riley got hired, not so much on the hiring itself, but really about how they tried to get up to speed at USC. And one of the interesting details in the story and your reporting was basically there was a runoff rule that USC found or utilized that probably a lot of people don't know about. Our colleague Max Olson is going to have a really interesting story, I think, go online, you know, in more detail about that specific rule. But let me ask you this, when you're hearing this, like, what's going through your mind, you know, just thinking in the context of, remember our old stories about our friend Houston Nutt and, you know, signing 38 guys and was the SEC running people off? And it was such a hot, you know, such a debate topic, whatever, like 8 or 9 years ago. And now all of a sudden, you know, Lincoln Riley, I think, was telling you directly, hey, this is what we're doing.
It wasn't so much like Lincoln Riley. Well, let me back up a second and just explain that the point of this story was not to revisit, hey, when did he first make contact with Oklahoma and Caleb Williams and all that stuff. It was, you know, frankly, could have been any school that went through a coaching change this past season. We just wanted to illustrate or give a glimpse into all of the things that happened behind the scenes leading up to a coaching change. And then once the coach is hired and once they have that press conference, all the million things that have to happen for him to hire a staff and turn over the roster and, you know, behind the scenes, the marketing of that they're doing and all those things. So of course, so my first interview of the day when I visited there a few weeks ago was with Lincoln Riley. And I did remember being surprised that he used the term forced attrition, that we forced some of the attrition here, because coaches don't usually admit to that. Later in the day, I sat down for an hour with Brandon Sosna, who's basically Mike Bone, DAD's, you know, number two man, and who was kind of handling the nitty gritty of the whole coaching transition, and Joseph Wood, who is the AD for, or assistant AD for football. And they spelled it out. They said, hey, our compliance department came back to us with this bylaw that we had never heard of, that frankly doesn't really, as far as I can tell, I'd never heard of it. It went kind of quietly went into effect in 2017, and it allows a coach in his first year on the job for up to a year to remove guys from the roster so long as the school honors their scholarship. Now, of course, in the case of a program like USC, most guys that happens to are going to enter the transfer portal, and they're not going to be, but you do it with the possibility that the guy's going to say, I don't want to leave USC, and you're going to be paying for his education until he completes his degree, even though he's not on the football team. They said they did that with 10 guys. So when you would hear stories about, well, Lincoln Riley himself has said, you know, we're turning over the roster, it's going to be the most unique roster that's ever been assembled, et cetera. They have had 41 scholarship players from last year's team leave. And some of that obviously is Drake London turns pro, or, you know, some guys did use up their eligibility, though with the COVID extra season, not that many, frankly, had used up their eligibility. And then, you know, Jackson Dart wasn't forced off the team. He wanted to transfer.
They had a handful of guys who jumped to the NFL draft and maybe didn't get drafted. Or, you know, I think there were former big recruits who were like, yeah, I'm going to go to the NFL. And the NFL, you know, probably wasn't.
They had nine guys who went professional, whether that was, you know, 3 years in, or maybe they could have come back and used the COVID season. They decided to move on. But yeah, they've had 20, 25 players as of this date either enter the portal or they did have a couple of medical retirements. Now, having said all that, like, you know, I saw people in the comments, even USC fans were like, yeah, that makes me feel a little bit icky that they were just forcing guys off the team. But we know that that even without that rule, this happens. Coaches, and when there's a coaching change.
It used to also happen a lot where players would get medicaled. So what that would mean is, was there an injury? If there was, then all of a sudden you had to honor the scholarship, but that player couldn't be part of your program essentially. And unless a player wanted to keep playing, that's how it was kind of couched in that. Maybe there was somebody who either didn't love football as much as the coaches thought that that person might when they recruited them. Maybe they just weren't very good. Maybe there was an injury, or maybe that just, you know, life kind of changed for them. Whatever it was, that was how a lot of guys got parted ways. Now, what I think is interesting is there used to be a part where it's like, oh, somebody was a list guy. And there was an explanation. Oh, this person either had too many positive pot tests, missed too many treatments, you know, missed too many classes, academically was lower, or whatever the issue was. What the issue really couldn't have been was that player sucked. You know, they tried, they sucked. You know,
you're not, I mean, technically you have to honor their, you cannot, you know, take a guy. And in fact, at some point we went to 4-year scholarships and you can't take that scholarship away for performance reasons. But, you know, I think with the transfer portal, there's this assumption that everybody that's in the transfer portal decided to enter the transfer portal, right? Because that's what coaches talk about. They complain about guys who, as soon as they hit some adversity, they quit, they leave the team. They are always looking for the next thing. The fact of the matter is there's a lot of guys in the portal who it wasn't necessarily their choice to be in the portal. Whether they were told, hey, it would be in your best interest to find a new school because you're not going to play here. Or in this case, with this new coach, literally, you know, above board, took them off the roster. So it's interesting. I feel like we've gone full circle in the span of a decade. You know, you mentioned it. I think it was around 2010, 2011, where there was a huge uproar about oversigning, as a lot of the SEC schools, and Alabama in particular, when Nick Saban was first building his dynasty, would sign 32, 33, whatever guys with the.
Remember, Houston signed, University of Houston, our guy Nutt signed 38 one year.
He did. And now some of those were JUCO guys, and there was this feeling of, there's an assumption that not all of them are going to get in, but we will stash them at a JUCO somewhere.
Yeah. And I think at that point, that reminds me, like, that point was actually something, how comfortable your athletic director who had to sign off on that. Cause I remembered working on Meat Market, same school, obviously, as where Houston Nutt was coaching a few years later, was the AD said, like, if we don't know that these kids are going to qualify, you can't send them scholarship papers, or you can't send them letter of intent. And so if some of those players were like, they're not going to sign with you, then all of a sudden you could end up with actually some left over, which is what I think might have happened either the year I worked on the book or the year after the book came out. And so it really got to be an interesting kind of seeing the sausage get made kind of process. And as you said, I don't know if we've come full circle, but we've definitely come, it's night and day difference compared to what it was. And maybe it's just now all of a sudden that there's some more transparency, and, you know, it just means they're probably more like employees, just one bigger step to being more like employees than anything else.
The reason I said we come full circle is at that time, you know, that caused some rule changes in the NCAA and at the conference levels to get to the point where, you know, it was always 25 scholarships per class. There didn't used to be necessarily rules nationwide limiting how many guys you could sign in a class, right? Mm-hmm. So eventually that became a hard cap too. Well, as we're recording this, it is Wednesday morning, and later today, the NCAA Division I Council will vote, and we believe approve, a pretty radical change to rosters in college football, which is no more 25 scholarship limit. Sign as many guys as you want, give out as many scholarships as you want in a given year, as long as you keep it at 85. Now, this is obviously a response to the portal and the immediate eligibility. Coaches are, in some situations, are finding that they can't, you know, replace guys as you know, guys are leaving at a faster pace than they can replace. They're dealing with that limit. Now this past cycle, they did do a one-time waiver to allow you to get up to 32 if you had seven guys transfer, but you had to replace them with transfers. Now it's saying, you know, you've heard coaches say this is a safety issue. We don't have enough guys to practice. Certainly in rebuilding situations, you know, Kansas for years was dealing with massive
right,
you know, below 85.
And 1 year at the AFCA meetings, I remember in the meeting talking to one of the assistants who came out, and he was like, yeah, Les Miles, who had just got to Kansas, was really stumping for them to get you know, this kind of, hey, give it a 2 year window for us to get back to the numbers. Because remember when David Beatty took over after Charlie Weiss went heavy on junior college players, and they were really in a deep hole, and Beatty got, you know, bailed a little water, but really was never able to recover. And I feel like that program, you know, has been reeling from it ever since.
Well, it shows you how quickly the climate has changed, because you're right. Jeff Long was the AD at the time, and he was pushing a proposal that would basically say you can only sign 50 over a 2 year period, but you can, it's up to you how many to spend in the first year or the second year. And that became a Big 12 proposal and didn't pass. It was rejected. And now it's only a few years later, and we're talking about, forget limiting it to 50 over 2 years. There's no limits. Sign as many people as you want, as long as you keep it to 85. So we know where this is headed. What Lincoln Riley did, that was a little bit hush hush, what other first year coaches have done in trying to purge the roster, is now going to be, you know, I think you're going to see that become standard. I don't exactly know that it'll necessarily always be that right when they first get there. But if you're in a situation where you take over a team and the roster stinks, you now are incentivized to basically lop off the bottom whatever percentage, because now you don't have to worry about the only thing that would have kept you from doing that in the past is you wouldn't have enough bodies because you could only sign 25. Now you know, hey, I could sign 40 kids this year if I want, between high school and transfers.
So let's spin this forward for a second, because this came up. The other day, I was talking to somebody about Georgia Tech as a football coach, and the point was, you know, Jeff Collins took over at a time, basically a couple of years where, you know, have basically been in the COVID, you know, era, and that is hard to get traction. And this person made the point, well, your best player by far leaves to go to Alabama, Jahmyr Gibbs, and how are you able to get any momentum in the portal era? And it's kind of flipped to how I would normally think it is, saying, well, you have more leeway and more opportunity to overhaul your roster quicker, much quicker than ever before. I would think, and boosters can, and money people can interpret it however they want, but I think I'll interpret it this way, is you have more opportunity to get better faster. So you better get better faster, or we're gonna have less patience because the rules have changed. But the flip side, I think, is also true, where it can be harder to build something, because if you have good players on a not so good team, like a Jahmyr Gibbs, they're more likely to leave now. And I think that will make it harder for the mid-level mediocre programs, as opposed to the places that may have some splash. And, you know, maybe you have a window, but that window is much smaller now.
I could see. So I have no idea how this will play out. Just like I had no idea how NIL would play out. We just have to see. I'm wondering though, if one scenario, you know, we've heard in the transfer portal era that it's having a ripple effect where less high school players are able to sign. There's just fewer spots available for high school players because coaches are deciding to use, in some cases, like look at Ole Miss.
Look at Texas State. They signed like pretty much nobody a year ago.
Yep. Yeah. You're seeing schools go from signing, let's say, 22 high school players and three JUCOs to, you know, 13 high school players and 14 transfers. So this is one way to get them back in the system. You could go back to signing 25 high school kids plus however many transfers you want, but then there's going to be a weeding out process. And people have brought this up, but it's kind of like the old Bear Bryant era, right? Where they would just sign kids just to keep them off their teams they play roster. Now the difference is those guys didn't have the 85 scholarship limit, so they could keep them as long as they wanted. You know, to get to 85 each year, you're probably going to have to say, okay, we bring in 25 high school players, and at the end of the first year, we'll say, okay, these 15 or so we can see you have a path here. The other 10, you guys go somewhere else. It's going to be fascinating to see how it all works. I think it's another example of, I think there's a lot of, right now, there's a lot of rush to, there's so much chaos and there's so much, so many coaches struggling to, what this comes down to is this a measure to get some control back in the hands of coaches. They feel like they've lost control of their ability to manage their own roster because of the portal and specifically the immediate eligibility waiver. Now, this is one way to give them some modicum of control back. It's only a matter of time, though, before people are going to be, it's going to go full circle again. We're going to go back to the 2010, 2011 debate. Hey, is this ethical that they're bringing in so many kids and then weeding them out immediately? What if the kid wants to stay there, et cetera? You're also going to have, I would think, not every coach is comfortable with running kids off. Some coaches don't want to do that, but they're going to feel pressure to because, you know, other coaches are using that to upgrade their roster. And if you don't do that, you're not going to upgrade your roster as fast.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
And without further ado, pleased to be joined by an old friend who has just, as we're taping this, it is Wednesday, Myron Roll, former Florida State star, former five-star recruit, Rhodes Scholar. I don't think you're ever a former Rhodes Scholar, are you, Myron? You're always a Rhodes Scholar, right?
Always a Rhodes Scholar, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Has his first book out, The 2% Way. It has football fingerprints all over it, dating back to his mentor, Mickey Andrews. Florida State fans and college football fans will remember that name. We're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about a lot of things with Myron. Myron, thanks for joining us on the Audible today.
Thanks for having me, Bruce. Appreciate it.
All right. So we have known each other for a long time. Pre-Florida State, back when I'd spent a bunch of time with you and your family for the Life of a Recruit story we did at ESPN Magazine back in lovely the Hun School in Galloway, New Jersey, right, or Princeton.
Yes,
and a lot has happened since then. But the obvious question is, you're not that old, but you've accomplished a ton of stuff. People see you on TV all the time. What made you want to write a book now?
Yeah, so, well, first, I have to say shout out to you for being such a good friend to me and my family, and to writing that great piece at ESPN Magazine. That was really cool. That was, like, literally my first feature that got me onto the radar screen of a lot of people around the country for my football. But you really talked about my academic success going to that prestigious prep school in Princeton at Hunt School, you know, it's a little bit different than your normal public school. So that was really cool. So thanks. But, you know, I was walking home from work at Mass General Hospital as a resident. At this point, I was a junior resident, and it was a 24-hour shift. I was very tired, and I typically talk to my wife, Latoya, when I'm leaving the hospital. And, you know, she was like, you know, Myron, I think you should write a book. And I'm like, no, nobody wants to hear from me in the doldrums of residency. It's cold. It's Boston. I don't know if I want to write a book now. But she was like, look, I believe in you. Every time we go out to eat or go somewhere or people write us messages, they're always saying how your story has inspired them. And I remember you saying how reading Ben Carson's story when you were younger inspired you to want to go into neurosurgery. So her sort of push and her belief in me was what I needed to start to activate this process. And then 9 months later, you know, I have a manuscript and have a publisher and have a literary agent. And it's just, it's a blessing that I'm able to put my life on paper, but then have a message be, you know, streamlined within the story arc of the 2% way, this mindset that I've used at each station, each season of my life to help me have success.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that, you know, because obviously Bobby Bowden was your head coach, Mickey Andrews was your defensive coordinator, and obviously hands-on with secondary guys. When you've been exposed to a lot of deep, deep thinkers, brilliant on the academic side. Just some of the ones I know off the top of my head are leaders in all sorts of fields. This philosophy, this kind of mindset that has been instilled in you as a very accomplished person, didn't come from the pure academic side. It came from basically the guy who helped you as a DB, Mickey Andrews. So how did you take what he was teaching football players, and how did it maybe either retrain your brain or give you a different kind of way of looking and absorbing and achieving?
That's a great point. You know, there definitely have been a lot of people who I've encountered in life that, you know, are incredible thinkers and, you know, leaders in a lot of different industries. But Coach Andrews' mindset, this 2% way that he got from Paul Bear Bryant when he was a player at University of Alabama, it just made so much sense, and it had so much versatility in all aspects of my person. Well, if you go out every day and practice and try to get a little bit better, small, tangible goals of improvement in your stamina and your ability to coming in and out of breaks, and your ability to high point the football, and your ability to disguise blitz packages when you're showing a cover two shell and you get down to the A gap by the time, you know, the ball snapped. These things were, it just made sense to me. And I extrapolated this thought, this mindset, this ideology into anything that I did in life. I wanted to grab 2% from it and then stack it on top of each other to have these consistent wins, small steps every day. So then a month from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, I can see the improvement and the growth I've made. And so I loved that philosophy. I thought it was simple. I thought it blocked out the background noise. I thought it made sense to me. And I love to apply it to all aspects of what I did, whether it be in my professional walk, trying to be a neurosurgeon, now here at Harvard doing that, my philanthropic life as a chairman of a foundation, my spiritual life, my familial life with my wife and my kids, whatever it is, you know, apply that 2% process. It's helped me tremendously, and that's why I hope that this book can resonate with individuals as well, because it has so much versatility, it has so much utility, and it makes a lot of sense, and it is a way to, again, silence everything outside of your focus, your small steps towards winning each day and getting better and seeing, you know, where you move from there.
So what I liked about the book was there's a lot of stuff in here that either I had forgotten or maybe I didn't know the depths, but one of the first things that jumped out at me was in the recruiting process, you had some boomer sooner in you, because I remembered you loved Bob Stoops, loved him, maybe didn't love the head coach at Michigan, but you loved Michigan, the school, right? And so having worked with Bob Stoops the past year, I'm like, all right, I can see why everybody loves Bob who's around Bob, you know? And it was interesting because I completely forgot about that, because everything I've known in the last couple of years of being around him, especially last year, was everybody in football loves Bob Stoops. He just treats people really well. Now, maybe if you were the media, you kind of saw a little bit, you know, a little bit of contrarian Bob, you know, at times. Whereas, you know, what I saw the last year, I'm like, everybody loves Bob. And you did. I remember how you felt about him coming out of, I think, your first offer, maybe, right, when you went to camp there. I'm curious how much, because you became a road, you pursued the Rhodes Scholarship because there was another elite high academic athlete at Florida State. But it's a kind of interesting path that has led you here, right? Because you could have gone anywhere out of high school. But the connection to go to Florida State, obviously as a New Jersey guy, with Penn State connections, right? Your brothers went to Penn State. Maybe your sister-in-law did too. Beyond Mickey Andrews, what are some of the other things that maybe have been very serendipitous about your path and because it went through Tallahassee?
Yeah, so you're right about Coach Dukes, man. I really do love that guy. I have, and I still do. We still communicate to this day. He is amazing. You know, as you remember, I went to that camp in Norman just to see if I could compete against talent that was outside of the state of New Jersey. And they were looking at this guy from Bishop Gorman, Ryan Reynolds, and they were looking at a guy from Edmond, Oklahoma, Reggie Smith. And, you know, they had a lot of people on their minds and not me at all. But when I finished that camp, I ended up with an offer. I ended up trying on Coach Stoops' rings that he had won at time in Florida and other rings he had from Iowa and all these different places. And it was just amazing. And offered me and said I was one of the youngest people has ever offered. Like Rod Woodson was another one that he offered at a young age. So bringing my name into categories with someone like the Hall of Famer Rod Woodson was huge. And even after I committed to Florida State, I stayed in touch with Coach Stoops. And I think he might have even remarked to the media one time that Myron Roll is, I think, the only recruit that continues to call me even after he committed somewhere else. Because that's how much I really enjoyed him. But Florida State was the right spot. It felt like the right spot to me. Going down there for my recruiting visit, being around Coach Bowden, who just had this grandfather-like figure to him. He was a Christian. My parents felt safe around him. They knew he wasn't going to bolt to go to the NFL. He was cemented in FSU for sure. Mickey Andrews the same way. He wasn't going anywhere. Put so many players into the National Football League. Samari, you know, my cousin was at FSU and really spoke highly of his time with Coach Andrews. You know, Garrett Johnson, the Rhodes Scholar you're speaking about, he was heavy in my, you know, in my path as well. So I saw what I can be by seeing someone like Garrett there. And then Jeb Bush wrote a text to our then president, T.K. Weatherall, that, you know, Florida State's a great place, and Myron, you should think about coming. So I just had everybody just showing a lot of love, and I felt like going there would mobilize the resources around me to eventually put myself in a position to be a Rhodes Scholar at a school that I think at the time needed an academic sort of juggernaut, an academic hero, somebody, a student athlete that would really put us on the next level and get us away from, you know, some of the reputation that we might have had. They needed me. I needed them. It worked out incredibly well. I love FSU. I went there for medical school as well, got trained there to become, you know, a neurosurgeon now here at Harvard. So it's been a fantastic ride, and I appreciated my time on the football field and off the football field at Florida State. I enjoyed both parts of my college tenure equally the same.
How much does it feel like you've been pretty prominent as a football player, but as really the scholar athlete? And you get into some of it in the book where you're talking to some of your teammates and, you know, maybe how you were viewed. I know there's obviously big responsibility with it. There's obviously big opportunity comes with it. At some point, did it ever feel like also a little bit of a burden where it would wear heavy on you to kind of be that guy for a lot of people?
You know, I think it did at first, but eventually it became so routine, and it's like, this is not going anywhere, Myron. If you want to continue to achieve success in the classroom, if you want to be a Rhodes Scholar or a neurosurgeon, you're going to have to continue to optimize all your academic opportunities. And so it wasn't going to get any better, so I realized that I had to embrace it, and I realized I had to figure out ways to help me through any stress that could come from it. And a part of that was enlisting the help of my teammates to really you know, helped guide me through it. Even though you all thought I was smart boy or president role or doctor role, whatever it was, you all, I need you to support me. I need you to protect me from, you know, the distractions that could lead us astray. I need you to pray for me if, you know, I'm going for the Rhodes Scholarship. You know, I'm sitting in the middle of the huddle, and prior to going to Birmingham, Alabama, my teammates put their hands on my shoulder and just said a big prayer in front of the whole team. It just, it was that sort of support that was necessary for me to, you know, continue to have success and wear that mantle of, wear that title of being a student athlete. Because when I succeeded, they felt like they succeeded as well. And I had to be vocal and be forthright that this was the plan that I wanted to have, and I can't do it alone. I can't operate in a silo. I can't be out here, you know, just trying to, you know, set the world on fire alone. I really do need you all. And that's been, I think, one of the secret keys to the success I've been able to gain, along with the 2% way. You know, you move slowly and you move forward, but you do it with other people in mind to help you, to help support your journey, to help buttress you forward. It's been a great ride for sure.
So we have something in common. We both have twins, boy girl twins. Mine are a little older than yours, not that much, but a little older. But then, in very Myron Roll fashion, you did everything in a very very profound way, and you decided, hey, I just not one set of twins, let's tee it up again 18 months later and have another set of boy girl twins. So now you have four under 2 years old.
Yeah.
How exhausting is it to be a first-time parent with four children, be a neurosurgeon, and try to balance everything you guys are juggling at once?
It's exhausting, and it is difficult at times, but I will say this, Bruce, you know, I think I told you off air that I follow your wife online, and I see how she's, you know, putting up pictures of your son and your daughter, you know, playing basketball, football, and you know, going to camps, and then, you know, your daughter, you know, winning different awards and doing amazing things. So I'm like, okay, this is what I have to look forward to. It's going to be good. It's going to get out of the phase of crying every 2 hours and needing milk every 2 hours, but we have a lot of support, Bruce. I mean, we have, my mother-in-law lives with us. I just bought a new house down in Orlando. My mother-in-law lives with me and my wife. My wife's a pediatric dentist, Latoya. So mother-in-law lives with us. Mommy and daddy, my parents, live 30 minutes away. We have a day nurse that comes. We have a night nurse that comes as well. My father-in-law is not very far either. So we essentially, to use a football phrase, we stack the box and we make sure that we have everything we need, you know, to try to support us. But it's great. You know, I know this is we didn't expect to have this many this early, but it's here. God's been a blessing. All of our kids are healthy. They're developing well. They sing and they dance, and we have them listening to gospel music at times, and they have their hands in the air and like praising the Lord. It cracks you up. Our daughter smiles. Our oldest daughter, Zora, her smile lights up a room. It's just, you know, any fatigue and lack of sleep that I get, it just sort of goes away when you see like her smile and him dance, and the youngest ones, you know, look up at you with these eyes of wonder. It's really, really cool. So it all works out.
Yeah. Just one thing it dawned on me a while back when we were talking was, back when I was in my ESPN days, I did a Q&A with you. I think you were at towards the end of your, you might have already graduated, but we talked about paying athletes, college athletes at the time. And I remember specifically asking you this question. How would it work? Like, would you pay the track athletes if there? And I remember you said, of course, because, you know, Florida State at the time, I think maybe they just won a national championship. And it's like, how do you not pay them? And my feeling was always like, I don't know how this, you know, honestly, I don't know how this works. I'm not against it. I just think logistically, it's a real big challenge. Now that we've had NIL almost a year, like, what has been your observations as somebody who probably could have, you know, made a lot of money capitalizing on your profile? To see what it is, where it's going, you know, you're still connected to college athletes as somebody who's spoken on committees. I mean, how do you think it's going?
Yeah, you know, I think the kid from Ponte Vedra would have probably had more NIL than me, but I think I would have done okay. Probably would have followed him up, Nice High School, Tim Tebow. But yeah, you know, I think that they have the right idea in the sense of allowing some compensation to these athletes for their work. I mean, I think I might have told you this story too, Bruce, that, you know, my older brother McKinley, you're very close to him too. He went to St. John's in Queens, New York, and we were in Manhattan one time, and the St. John's had this really good basketball player who I loved, one of my favorite college basketball players of all time, named Marcus Hatton. And we're walking in Times Square, and there's this huge billboard. And, oh, by the way, Marcus Hatton, his number, jersey number, was number one. So you walk into Times Square, and then you see this huge billboard that says, there's only one Manhattan, and his number is one, and then it's man, and then a dash, and Hatton, like you spell his last name. And I'm thinking to myself, man, number one, this is tight. This is really, really cool. I like the way this looks. I would love for me to be on a billboard one day. But the second thought that came immediately after that was, I wonder if he's getting paid for that. Like, I wonder if Marcus Hatton is eating at McDonald's right now because he can't afford anything else, because, you know, but his name is shining on lights in Times Square. So at that point, I realized it was important to compensate these athletes. I think there's a mechanism, maybe a better mechanism that they're doing right now, at least some structure. You don't want it to get out of hand where, you know, track athletes or the phenomenal soccer athlete as a woman or this phenomenal field hockey player feels left out or maybe not as celebrated or doesn't have the same level of opportunity or access to the kind of monies that the football male basketball players may get. So I think there's going to be some tweaks and maybe a little bit more structure that could go into it. I would hate to see, again, those female athletes that work so hard and that grind so much and win all the time but aren't celebrated on TV as much as football and basketball, them not, you know, have a shot at what, you know, a player from Western Kentucky can, you know, football player from Western Kentucky can get. So I like the whole idea, the concept, but I think there got to be some guardrails in here somewhere placed. I don't know where, but they got to be.
Yeah. Well, tell people where they can get the 2% Whey. I imagine it's pretty much everywhere at this point now that it released on Tuesday.
Yes, absolutely. So released on Tuesday, and you can get it anywhere that you get books online, Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, wherever. And it's available in all formats, so audio and hardback, softback, whatever you need. We're excited about it. On my website, www.2percentway.com, TWO percentway.com. You can get it there. You can go to my social media. I have it linked there as well. So we try to make it not hard to find. We hope that it reaches a lot of people. You know, this story and talking about this process of overcoming challenges, making something that seems overwhelming and daunting, breaking it down into smaller pieces so that you can have those small victories every single day, is definitely useful for anyone, parent, coach, teacher, whatever. And you'll see some of the issues that I went through, the self-doubt, the uncertainty, the prejudice, the racism, maybe feeling like I'm socially awkward and don't belong in certain settings, doubting myself and thinking that I'm maybe not enough or not good enough surgeon to handle certain surgeries, or even workplace challenges, or even, you know, dealing with my wife and being distanced from her and trying to manage those challenges of raising a family and being together and being on the same page, even though we're separate and apart. So a lot of human experiences are in this book, and I think it can hit home to a lot of people. So we're very excited about it.
Yeah, and I think it does, just from having read the first half of it, I think it does a very good job of connecting, giving a window into you fitting in. New Jersey kid from who went to a prep school going to Tallahassee at a time where, you know, I think, like you said, you could help them image-wise as much as they could help you. And I thought it was interesting, your acclimation process and how you connected with people there and how they connected with you, I thought was very cool to read. All right. So for people who want to follow you online, it's still just at Myron Roll. And are you still doing some, you still going and doing a lot of speaking aside from the book promotion?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, we have a couple, you know, book signing events that we're doing, Tallahassee and Jacksonville, coordinating some in Nassau, Bahamas, back in the crib, you know, going to be a couple up here in Boston as well. So, yeah, a lot. And, you know, we're just, you know, doing the best we can to, you know, allow this book to get into the airspace of as many people as possible. And then just my story to do the same. I connected with someone like Ben Carson when I was younger, and I know how it really, really changed my life. And maybe that can that can be the case for someone who comes across my story. So that'd be outstanding.
Awesome. Myron, it's great connecting with you again. Best of luck on the book. I'm sure it'll do great. And we appreciate you taking the time to join us on the Audible today.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate you having me.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
What do you say we get to the mailbag?
As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Stu, what's first on your list?
All right, first, I just want to give out a disclaimer. Almost every single question we got this week was about NIL. Bruce, you know, I get it. It's the topic of the moment, but I feel like Bruce and I kind of feel like we've run out of things to say on it. So we've limited it to one NIL question, and we would encourage you guys to ask about other things football related. Blaine from Virginia. Okay, Bruce, I got to admit, I'm not watching it USFL for 1 minute, so I can't answer this, but you can. I know the archaic and slow chain gang drives Stu nuts. That is true. Since the USFL is a Fox partner, how have the electronic change, how have the electronic chains worked out, Bruce? Do you think it'll be brought over to college and the NFL? This is something I've been saying for probably a decade. Why are we still using 1940s technology to determine the spot of the ball? Can't we use GPS trackers? Apparently, the USFL has tried that. With what kind of results?
Yeah, so it's a little tricky because early on, I thought it was just kickers, but it's actually, I guess, quarterbacks too had some frustration. So the chip inside the ball or that technology adds, you know, 4 or 5 ounces to the ball, and how it's distributed within the ball, I guess, is not evenly. So it's caused some frustration. I think that they have tried to address that in certain situations, which ball they're going to use as opposed to that technology. One of the things that had come up, I thought, was if, especially, you know, when you think of kickers, you're thinking of kickers and punters, but I think it's more the kickers because of the spin of the ball and the rotation of the ball with it inside. But also when you're thinking about it, it's not like you're going to throw a pass end over end. And I guess there was a little bit of frustration on that part. So I don't know. Like, I'm a huge football fan, so I've watched a decent amount of it, and just, you know, having friends who are working on the broadcasts, it's also kind of got me to keep an eye on it. You know, it's been kind of a mixed bag. There's not a lot of, you know, even for diehard college football fans, There's not a lot of there's way less recognizable names than I think most people would think. I mean, you're sitting there watching games and Jonathan Adams, who, you know, remember in the COVID year at Arkansas State, just, you know, broke out and was a big time guy. And you're like, man, I'm surprised that guy's not in the NFL. But getting back to the technology piece, there's a bunch of interesting innovations that are going on. I think some may stick or may get refined, and other ones are, like, you know, probably going to get thrown onto the scrap heap that are coming out of this. And I'm sure the XFL next year will, you know, that's the one that The Rock is involved with, will probably try to have some of their own initiatives as well.
I hope they can make that GPS thing work, because it's, when you really think about it, this is a sport. There's so much at stake in this sport, people's livelihoods, millions, if not billions of dollars. And oftentimes the game comes down to a spot, right? I mean, think of the JT Barrett, Ohio State, Michigan game. It is so unscientific. You'll be on the sideline. You've obviously been on the sidelines a lot, and you look over at the guys who are holding the chains. These guys are volunteers. Like, these guys are librarians or whatever during the week. And on Saturdays, they get to come hold the chains. It seems, it just doesn't fit with the overall professionalization of the sport. All right, here's a good football one from Dave in Charlotte. Which new coordinators will have the biggest impact on their new school?
And I'm going to take one offensive guy and one defensive guy. My offensive guy is going to be a name that probably not a lot of people will be familiar with, unless you're looked at a lot of Group of Five or live in Lubbock, and that's Zach Kittley, former, you know, he's a protege of Cliff Kingsbury. And the way I would describe it from talking to coaches on that staff now in Lubbock is, this is not your father's air raid offense. There's a big portion of that, but then there's some definite wrinkles that are different. He was at Houston Baptist. They average almost 50 points a game, I think their second year. And then he went to Western Kentucky, brought Bailey Zappi, and they broke all sorts of records there. And, like, I think, you know, look, to me, Texas Tech, and I'm not saying they're going to go back to where Leach was and they're going to be dangerous and nationally relevant. That may happen. That may not. But I think the Big 12, sooner than, you know, later, is kind of going to go up for grabs again, right? We'll see. I think Oklahoma's not going to drop off much this year under the coaching change, but I feel like, you know, it's you just have a lot of new blood there, right? New coach at TCU, new coach at OU. Baylor had a really good year. So I was like, I'm not saying Texas Tech is going to come in and win the conference, but I think they're going to go back to putting up a lot of big numbers. On the defensive side, I'm going to take a former Big 12 guy, and that's Jim Knowles. And I think Oklahoma State, he made them very good on defense. You know, they were a problem because of how he managed things, and they gave people headaches. Now he's going to go to a place where he's going to have a lot more talent up front. And Ohio State has had a lot of issues, though, on the back end. And I feel like, you know, last year, for a team that has had so many high draft picks, you know, in the last few years, and they've had still a bunch of 4 and 5 star guys back there. It's been pretty well underwhelming on defense. At times they've been lost. They were good when Jeff Hafley was there. And then after that, it's been a very mixed bag. And I think Jim Knowles was a really good hire, and I think he has a chance to fix a lot of that. You?
Yeah. Jim Knowles is the obvious answer for this question, just because he did such a tremendous job at Oklahoma State. And like you said, I mean, he's walking into what should be one of the more talented, you know, oftentimes you're a defensive coordinator taking over a program where the talent level has really dipped. That maybe it's a little bit down at Ohio State, but we know it's still for the most part a bunch of guys who with NFL potential. So,
I mean, you go back to that game, the Oregon game, and you're just watching them get, like, exposed, you know, like the linebackers struggle, the people on the back end looked lost. They didn't get the pressure they used to get. Obviously, you know, they had Chase Young before, and they had, you know, generational talent guys up front, not just 5-star guys. They had, you know, real different players. I'm interested to see how it'll go there. I mean, I think Ryan Day, and as we tape this podcast, you know, they're just, you know, announced that he's got a contract extension for a couple more years and a couple more $1 million. I like the hires he made, the additions he made, both Justin Fry on the O-line where they had been shaky last year, and certainly Knowles. I think those are two really good additions for the Buckeyes.
Now, sometimes it's hard to separate when there's a head coaching change, you know, head coaches and coordinator impact. But one I'll point out is Oregon and Kenny Dillingham coming in as the offensive coordinator. Look, he's replacing a very accomplished offense coordinator, Joe Moorhead, but Oregon's offense stunk last year. There's no way around it. They never could figure out what exactly they were doing. And people got frustrated because it seemed like they weren't, especially when it's Oregon and you're used to these, you know, going back to Chip Kelly, these really explosive offenses, that was, you know, a very not explosive offense. Well, so Dan Lanning brings in Kenny Dillingham, and in the spring game, Oregon looks like a completely different offense. They've got Bo Nix now there at quarterback. He's throwing the ball around the yard, just a much more wide open, aggressive approach than what they were doing the last couple of years of Mario Cristobal's tenure. Now, I'm not saying Kenny Dillingham doesn't necessarily have a track record as a highly accomplished OC, so I'm not necessarily coming out here and predicting that they'll...
And he's never been a play caller before, so...
Well, we'll find out. Also, I mean, I think I know what's going to happen because I've seen 3 years of Bo Nix. I think he's going to make a lot of exciting plays, and he's going to have games where he throws 3 or 4 interceptions. But if nothing else, there'll be it'll be an impact. Let's put it that way. And then there's just ones where, like, the team is already pretty good, so I don't know that you're necessarily going to see a huge improvement, but I'm interested to see the transition from Mike Elko, who was had so many great defenses at Texas A&M, to DJ Durkin, who's coming off a pretty remarkable improvement at Ole Miss, but not, they weren't obviously at the level that A&M was last season. You know, there's a few of those like that. You know, will Derek Mason be able to sustain what Jim Knowles was doing at Oklahoma State? Ones like that.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how it goes at Oregon with Dillingham and Dan Lanning. Keep in mind, Dan Lanning, obviously defensive coordinator by trade, comes from the SEC, learned under Nick Saban, but also learned under Kirby Smart. Will he want to be wide open? I mean, I think the thing that sometimes people forget is when you're a head coach, they're mindful at times of playing what's called complementary football. And if you're throwing it all over the yard, as you were talking about in a spring game, that may not be what you see. So we'll see if it looks like a Big 12 kind of style offense going after Georgia in week one with the Ducks or not.
By the way, another under the radar one, I mean, almost you forget this happened, but Manny Diaz is the defensive coordinator of Penn State now.
Yeah, and a part of the reason why James Franklin wanted Manny Diaz, who, look, he had success as a coordinator, but he felt like there was a lot of similarities in terms of scheme and what he's done compared to Brent Pry. And so, and there's some good talent there to work with. So you're right. I think that will be an interesting one to keep an eye on there in the Big Ten.
All right, the NIL question I chose was this one because I've heard it a lot. Matthew Akers asks us, dear Stu and Bruce, do you think that the college football facilities arms race will slow down as a result of boosters putting more financial resources into NIL collectives? I would imagine that boosters will still contribute money towards facility improvements, but not at the same pace as before the NIL era. Obviously, TBD. Too early to say how that's going to play out, though I will say that Andy Staples went to Texas A&M recently, did an interesting story there. And the answer, if you're just going off that one small sample size of that one school, the answer is no, it hasn't affected it at all. They just announced a huge capital campaign to, I believe, build a new football facility, which is crazy because I've been to their football facility and it's perfectly nice the way it is. So we know they're doing very well with their NIL collective and they're, you know, launching this campaign. I think people underestimate, if you're filthy rich enough to be throwing millions of dollars at high school players, you've got a lot of money to burn. And I don't necessarily know that it's one or the other.
Also, in our story that I did with Manny Navarro that went up today on our site, it's also talked about, you know, Miami's ready to put, you know, a shovel in the ground and they're going to work on a new football facility, you know, and, you know, hope to be able to have it in for the 2023 class. I mean, so they're moving fast on it. And obviously, as you said, they're aggressive in all their resources now. One thing that would not shock me, you know, like we're obviously on the infancy stage, it's not even a year into NIL, is I think there is going to be some course correction of how some of the money gets thrown around. I think the idea of, hey, the collectives or, you know, agents and are scrambling and it's all of a sudden going to be throwing seven figures at players who haven't done anything when you may have players who are proven on your roster who are not getting as much. I think there's going to be some, I think there's going to be some belt tightening on that, because how many of these players who are going to be getting contracts, now they may not be end up getting this, you know, seven figures ultimately, but are going to be lining up for those deals and are being, you know, shopped around by agents. I don't know, you know, how that business model is going to work out when a bunch of these players end up turning out to not be able to produce at that level. You know, I think that's the part where, you know, for some of this money, you're going to have to expect Cam Newton type impacts at programs. And we just know that's not going to work out that way. There may be 1 in 10 that do that. There may be 1 in 10 that, you know, and I'm not even talking obviously Cam Newton was a generational talent, but, you know, think about some of the 5-star players who've come out. Like that's right now, there's a lot of money being thrown that, you know, realistically, do you think a third of those kids are going to live up to it?
No, but I can see both sides of this. So that's one theory, that after a year or two of people seeing these recruits they threw all this money at not panning out, that they will pull back on spending that kind of money. The flip side of that would be, why would this be any different than the coaching cycles, where how many times do we see a coach get bought out for $15, $20 million?
I think the difference on that is coaches do have a track record before they get the money.
Not necessarily.
No, I mean, you can't tell me that there's a coach who didn't have some kind of track record that they're not awarding it almost like lottery winners. You know, to me, that's the different part of this, where I could definitely see if there's another version of Jordan Addison that comes out, or some, you know, not even a Pitt, but some Group of Five player who lights it up and people realize, oh, he should have been, you know, a 4-star rated player or a 5-star rated player. Then the bidding war goes in. And I'm not saying that like no one's going to ever pay for a high school player again, because I know that they will. I'm just saying the talk of the agent feeding frenzy, I think that is going to get more pushback now, just because I think you're going to see schools go, hey, you know, we're not paying $2 million a year for this quarterback because he hasn't done anything, and we got a better player in our program who actually has. You know, it's just, I think that's the stuff where it's going to create a lot more problems. You're talking about coaches, but coaches aren't, you know, whoever the coach is, they weren't just hired off the street.
No, what I'm saying is you know, let's say you're Florida State, you hire Willie Taggart. He turns out to be a disaster. You got to pay $20 million to buy him out. You would think the next contract you give out to a coach wouldn't fall for that again, but they do. They always get Jimmy Sexton, whoever, always convinces them to hand out another completely one-sided contract.
But Mike Norvell, use the example of Florida State. Mike Norvell had a really good 4-year run or 3-year run at Memphis. And it wasn't like, it's much different to me than taking somebody who's never played college football at any level. You're basing it off, in some cases, like some of these deals we're talking about now, they're based off like 7-on-7 leagues and camps. That's not college football. You know, it's just a different deal. Now, Dan Lanning, no doubt. I mean, if you're a first-time head coach, it is a gamble. I don't think it is as wildly, you know, like, to me, it's just a different dynamic, though, than you already have players on your roster who may be more proven, and now you're going to be putting way more of an investment in somebody who's not even going to be there for a year. That's my point.
So, yeah, I could see, you know, what I could see is a reallocation of that money. Because, you know, to this point, the big, most splashy contracts we're hearing about are going to recruits, and in particular, kids who aren't even in their senior year of high school. I could see it reversing itself where that money starts going more toward transfer portal, like a Jordan Addison. If we're going to start to see more players of his caliber enter the portal, like that to me is a better use of your, or, and Danny Staples has pointed this out, you know, if you've got a kid who could turn pro, right, and possibly be a, not a first round pick, but mid-level pick, give him a seven-figure NIL deal for his to come back for one more season.
I'm going to read you a quote from a coach I talked to this week. You see all these articles with all these guys hitting the transfer portal, and they say the number one issue is tampering. But that's not the case. It's the agents, man. These agents are out of control in football and what they're asking for. It's not schools like all those stories talking about. The schools are offering $300,000 or $400,000 for me to leave. No, that's not the case. Your agent was calling around saying, hey, I got a guy who may be interested in getting in the portal. What would you offer him? The agents have quietly gone under the radar, and they're at the root of this whole money crisis.
So those last two words are really, really telling, huh? Money crisis. Well, how is this a crisis that athletes are making a lot of money?
I think it's a crisis, not that athletes are getting a lot of money. I think the issue comes back to you are spending, these collectives are throwing a lot of money at players who are not yet in their program, and they're going to be, they're commanding and trying to get way more money than anybody else who's in the program. That's the issue, I think, that is a challenge for coaches to sort out.
I've said many times that this will eventually normalize itself, but by normalize, I don't mean the value, the number of dollar signs you're seeing are going to go back to shrinking. I mean, this is a free market, and what we're learning is that if there had been a free market all this time, there would have been a lot of money going toward the athletes. And
there was a lot of money going towards some athletes.
Towards some athletes, yeah, under the table, but we're seeing it, you know, I think... at a scale that I don't think was happening under the table. So when I say normalize itself, I mean maybe some of the outlandish figures you're seeing for high school recruits, maybe that turns out to be an outlier. But again, like that money will find its way to somebody. Maybe it'll be a current player, maybe it'll be a transfer portal kid. This is money that rabid college football fans have to burn, and they want to spend it on may helping their team win a championship. It's not a rational market, right? It's not a a Fortune 500 company where if they spend a gazillion dollars developing a product and it doesn't work out, then they pull the plug, because why would you keep doing something that's operating at a loss? If anything, you could see, okay, well, we spent all this money on the recruiting class and it didn't turn out, so maybe we need to spend more money. Maybe we just didn't spend enough. We're not talking about rational actors here. We're talking about fans who want to win a championship, or Phil Knight, or somebody, you know, who's got more money than he knows what to do with. And if it turns out that
more money than he knows what to do with, and less probably time than he knows his own, biological clock is ticking.
Yep, and he wants a national championship. So he better hope that Dan Lanning does turn out to be every bit. Whatever they're paying him, worth it. All right, send your questions to audiblepod@gmail.com. And again, like, we love any number of topics you could ask us about, and they don't have to be NIL, because that's not going away. We'll see you next time.